Support for IPR comes from Corridor Vein Center and Corridor Aesthetics, treatment for varicose veins and spider veins, also providing facial rejuvenation services and treatment for moderate to severe acne. More at Corridor Vein and CorridorAesthetics.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many of the books being challenged in Iowa and around the country are the work of Black authors and feature Black characters. Some of the books have been challenged because of language or because of difficult subject matter. Some of the subject matter that has been deemed too difficult for young people to engage with is taken from life experience. Great books can act as mirrors and windows. It's powerful to see your identity and experience reflected in a book, and it's powerful to have the opportunity to understand the lives and experiences of people who are different from you. Amari Nassafi is a high school English teacher at West High School in Iowa City. In addition to ninth grade English, he also teaches African American literature, and he has put together a list of powerful books for us. Amari, welcome to the show.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's start with that idea of mirrors and windows, because, of course, you are putting books in the hands of teenagers every day, whether that's something they appreciate or not. And so you probably see students who take a book and can see themselves reflected in the book. How do you see that impacting students?
Yesterday with a student in my ninth grade class, and we were kind of going over his resistance to reading. And so I just sat down and asked him, like, what was the last time that you know, fully, deeply engaged with a book? And so he, you know, pulls up his Chromebook and he Googles this book. He's like, I read this in seventh grade. And I think for this student who is Black, the fact that he could identify with the main characters of this book, right? Because not only, you know, ethnically, but also the way they grew up, their life situations. I think the reason he was able to identify so closely was because that book acted like a mirror that provided some self-affirmation.
Do you remember the first time you saw yourself reflected in a book?
I was thinking about this question today, and just to clarify things, I'm a Black man who's, yeah, I'm a mixed race ancestry, right? So that makes things sort of idiosyncratic and complicated in some contexts and not in others. But at most spaces I move in the world, you know, I self-identify and others see me as a Black man. And so and if you're thinking about this metaphor, an important thing is to be able to see yourself in a book. The first time I remember, I had encountered a few Black characters in children's literature, but not that many. Like the first books I remember truly being in love with intellectually and in my heart were Roald Dahl books.
Yeah.
But the first time I encountered a book that really acted like a mirror for me was probably all the way till I was in sixth grade. There was this library across from our middle school, being just a bookworm, I would saunter on over eventually to the library and hang out after school. And I remember just kind of walking, like, you know this, you're a book lover. People who are book lovers love to just meander around libraries and stumble upon things. And I knew who Malcolm X was, but I remember just picking up his autobiography, thinking maybe it would be too big, complicated, and heavy for me. And what it did was not only act like a mirror, but it opened up a sort of synthesis of different personality types and perspectives that allowed me to re-envision who I could be. It opened up a new possibility for me in my own coming of age story. Wow. I guess I would, like, specifically, he seemed to integrate these different personality types that I had never seen integrated in a person before. Like this supremely confident, prideful man who was also in love with ideas and intellectually oriented. And I had never met a Black man like that in my, you know, limited experience growing up in Sioux City. And so that opened up a new possibility that not only could I do that, but it might be, you know, a powerful way to live.
And the first book on your list is a nonfiction book, and it's a version of a nonfiction book for younger readers. Tell me about Stamped.
Well, I don't know if you've read anything by Jason Reynolds, you know that he has this just absolutely magnetic personality, and that comes through in his writing style as well. I mean, he's just, he'd be an absolutely beautiful teacher. He knows how to connect to people, specifically young people, and through their minds. What I'd say about it is it presents a side of American history and helps orient the reader toward encountering something that they might not otherwise be disposed to, right? And what I've heard in my personal conversations, I've had conversations with people that would prefer not to see that book in the hands of kids. And I think one of the reasons they present that or they have that belief is because they're worried that people are going to walk away with young people of color thinking that, you know, this entire society is constructed to be set against them. And I think that if you read that book a certain way, you could come away with that perspective, right? And it's not one that I share, but I think that especially for the young person who has not, for whatever reasons, been engaged with the history of racism in American society, it's an important book to read and grapple with, right? And I don't think it's, I would insist upon it not being necessary for you to agree with all of the ideas put forward in the book, but to be scared or disenchanted with the idea of engaging with it, I think is doing yourself an intellectual disservice.
Well, and this version, the full title is Stamped: Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. And Ibram Kendi wrote a book for adults first, Stamped from the Beginning, which is the definitive history of racist ideas in America. This is a version for younger readers. And you mentioned Jason Reynolds. So Jason Reynolds wrote it with him. And Jason Reynolds has written all of these just wonderful, wonderful books for middle grade readers. And like you said, he has this voice that is so engaging and so fun. And I have read both Ibram Kendi's version for grownups, and then I read the book for middle grade students with my son. And it's so much fun. Which doesn't sound like the right way to talk about a book that is about really difficult history, but his voice and his charisma really helps you engage with this subject matter in a really unique way. I just think it's a brilliant book.
Yeah, I would second what you said about Reynolds. I mean, charisma is the right word. And I think in my own reading experience, I kind of had a dead zone in my reading in my middle grade years, where kind of after sixth grade or so, after that encounter with the autobiography of Malcolm X, I felt like there wasn't a lot of places for me to go, as, in terms of mirrors, at least. And then it kind of took till I got to, you know, the African-American literary canon, if you want to call it that. And when I got older and was able to grapple with some of that stuff before I read it, I often think when I see a bunch of my students walking around with Jason Reynolds in their hands, I think, oh, how, you know, great would that have been to be able to have access to a writer like that?
Absolutely. Well, and then the second book that you put on your list also includes Jason Reynolds, although it's not all Jason Reynolds, but it's a short story collection called Black Enough. Tell me about it.
You know, this is the book as I was putting together a short little list, thinking about what's one book that I wish would have been maybe around when I was in my early teens. And I think this is it for a couple of reasons. One, there's a collection of, you know, Black authors from all kinds of different backgrounds, experiences, orientations. And I think like that helps reinforce the idea of diversity within Black thought. You know, some of my white friends and colleagues really want to get oriented and have a more deeply engaged experience with Black culture, right? And the one way to get access to that is through literature. But what you don't want to do is kind of give me the five books to read and I will come away being an expert on what it's like to be Black in the US. You know, you don't want to have that naive idea. So a better plan would be to like expose yourself to a bunch of different windows. And I think Black Enough does that. It's this beautiful collection of stories by a bunch of different authors. And you just get peeks into all of these different life experiences, you know, from what it's like to grow up with a half sibling that you sort of have this resentment for in a story like Half Moon, to like what some authors call Black Boy Joy. This is a story called The Ingredients, where Jason Reynolds just, so, as you said, charismatically renders, you know, a sort of day in the life tale of these friends who were just up to these everyday quotidian sort of activities. But you get a peek into the sound, the different flavor that Black love and friendship can have. And so, I mean, those are a couple of the stories I'd highlight. But yeah, it's short. You know, the stories in there aren't very long. You get a bunch of different perspectives. There's a bunch of, you know, immensely talented young writers in there. So I would encourage Black Enough. Check that out.
Black Enough a short story collection, including short stories by Jason Reynolds and Nick Stone. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I am talking to Amari Nassafi. He's a high school English teacher at West High School in Iowa City, and we're putting together a reading list this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me is Amari Nassafi. He's a high school English teacher at West High School in Iowa City. He teaches ninth grade English, and he also teaches African American literature. And we're talking about a selection of books that he recommends pretty much anybody read to engage with some great literature by Black Americans. The next book on your list, Amari, is one that has recently been in the news. Again, it's a book that has recently been challenged, although it's also a classic that I think a lot of us, even people who haven't read a lot of Black literature, have read, and that's The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. Tell me why you think this is an important book to read.
Well, I think the thing for me with Morrison is in terms of pure aesthetics, she's, to me, the most beautiful author in our tradition. I remember this was the first book, The Bluest Eye was the first book of hers that I read, and I was just absolutely, floored by one of those experiences as a reader where you are going through the sentences and just realizing, wow, I could never do that. but it's so beautifully rendered. Some of the themes that she covers, the range of characters, the way she represents the sound of Black conversation, the different flavor, as I mentioned before, of Black love that we see experienced there, and then harder themes to tackle, and particularly it's a great representation of the problems that occur when people don't have those mirrors reflected, not only in literature, but in the broader society. When the standard of beauty and all you see represented at the highest levels of it don't, quote unquote, look like you, don't have the same phenotypical characteristics as you are. It's so hard to form aspirational role models or feel like you fit, and what kind of psychological problems that can cause for young people of color in a predominantly white society. Those are some of the themes, and it's a very dense novel that can withstand a lot of readings, but I think it shouldn't intimidate people. But those are some of the things that I've gotten out of that book.
Well, and I know that, of course, she does engage with some really difficult subject matter in the book, but that's also inspired by her life. And it always, I really struggle when I see people say, kids shouldn't read this because it's too ugly, it's too hard. But it happened to a child, and things like this happen to children all the time. It feels like an opportunity to empathize and experience something and understand something important without, thank goodness, having to live through it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, your individual child's, child development, something to consider what stage they're ready for things at. But I 100% agree that, protecting people from ideas and experiences that actual people are having in the world forever isn't a way to release them out into the wider society when they're 18 years old. I think encountering and grappling with some of these realities that are within our families, communities, and societies are really, that's a really important thing to do.
That's The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. And now the next book on your list is it's a recent book, just published a couple years ago, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. Tell me about this one.
The Vanishing Half. So we have this book at West, and we just finished reading it and had some, this book has been really opened up in multiple levels to me by my students. So I think in our conversations about these mirrors and windows, even within the Black experience, I think there's so many different ways that your life can play out and different perspectives you have. And the vanishing half, you know, represents a lot of experiences for a Black person in the United States that I don't have. And I think particularly some of the young women in my classes have really opened up parts of this book to me. So it focuses on the subject of passing. These two twins, Stella and Desiree, are growing up in this town that is, in one sense, it's a Black town, but also it's called Mallard. But also this town is possessed by a culture of continuously trying to move toward whiteness. And in that sense, it's a book that explores colorism. So within the Black community and across the world in many societies, there's this preference and drive toward increasingly lighter skin. And that's really taken hold and gripped this culture in Mallard. And these twins, they leave Mallard, and then without giving away too much, their stories sort of bifurcate. And something that I'm really interested in thinking about in relationship to that book is the way that I feel Bennett explores the relationship between the brain and rationality as a tool for decision making and guiding you through life versus the heart and emotion, and the way that that plays out through these characters' lives and intermingles. It makes for a really complex, chronologically fragmented, but also like accessible book. So it works on multiple levels. I think the more you read it, the more complex it is. My students have helped me to see that. So
you must have a really unique opportunity in that class, African American literature, because it's an elective class. Nobody is required to take it. So the students who come to you for that class, they really want this education. You've got Black students in the class. You've got white students in the class. You've got other students of other backgrounds. What is that dynamic like? What has that given your students the opportunity to do?
They're hungry to have not just the conversation, you know, capital T, capital C, that we talk about so much in our culture, but have it be an ongoing discourse throughout the year, right? And so I've seen that they're hungry for it, right? They want to engage with these ideas. They want to have a class. It feels like such an important moment in our society to be able to engage these, I don't want to say engage these issues, because I don't want to focus on only, the strife and struggle that is part of being Black in America, but also just have a place where we can learn from each other in exchange for the Black students, for them to have a place where they can focus on artistic representations of their own experience, and then engage with students who don't share that background, who seem to be very eager to learn and discuss and open themselves up to different perspectives. It's been wonderful. At times it's been difficult. We've had hard conversations. We've had disagreements. I think it's I've learned a lot. I mean, it's a class that I've taught the least, but I've learned the most in my teaching of it. And it's been a really meaningful experience for me, and I hope for the students.
I'm sure for the students. And I think that there are so few opportunities in life to engage in that way, that it sounds like a really special opportunity that I'm sure your students will not forget. And so we were just talking about The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, which is one of the books that you assigned this year to your high school students. The next book on your list is Losing My Cool by Thomas Chatterton Williams. Tell me about this one.
So Williams is coming from a perspective, or at least a background, that when I picked up the book, I mean, we're very close to the same age. He, like me, has a Black father, a white mother. We came of age very close at the same time. And so we had similar musical tastes. And I would say I picked this book because it's the one that I found the closest mirror in. And so what I see in this book is a coming of age story and a young man who is really captivated by hip hop music and all the version of it that he is entranced with and what that seems to represent. And he really does a beautiful job of exploring how that influences his values. A particular thing that sticks out to me in this book that I think is so important is his exploration of what it means to feel as though you have to fit a certain personality type or expression to be considered authentically Black, right? So at the crux of his sort of coming of age identity crisis is he feels pulled toward a certain type of intellectual life and a certain style of decision making, but at the same time he's deeply tied to his friends and his community. And when he feels those things aren't aligning, you know, what do you abandon that sense of belonging and kind of, you know, pursue your own road? And so yeah, the exploration of that as he's coming of age, I thought was really fascinating to me. And I think that that's something that's better for this generation of young Black people in the U.S. than it has been in the past. I feel like there are more lanes open up, as the way I often describe it, like within the Black experience to express and things to be into and personality types. And so I think he does a great job of opening those things up. And I think some of the stories in Black Enough do the same thing.
Well, the last book on your list, I think, is a window for so many people. It's Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And she is a Nigerian author. And the book is written from the perspective of an African student living in the United States, observing race in the United States. So that feels like a window for everybody who's not African.
100%. And that's like, you just summarize exactly kind of my thinking and my choice behind that book. Because before I had read it, I had a couple of, you know, growing up, most of the Black people I knew and in the community were descendants of American slaves, right? Rather than people, you know, descendants of people who immigrated thereafter. And so this is a perspective that in my own personal life has been sort of, I don't know, almost absent, right, in my interactions with people. And so opening up that book really cracked open a whole new perspective. Like, what would it be like to kind of descend into America and see race relations as a Black person, but not having grown up culturally or historically in that environment? And it's just amazing. Like, one of the beautiful things I think it did for me was sort of like, it was so affirming for me to see from that perspective, right? Someone who hadn't grown up with, you know, there's colorism and racism in Nigeria. I'm not saying that doesn't exist, but like to see through her eyes what some of our societal relations look like was amazing. And then also to see through the eyes of a woman, I think was a really eye-opening experience for me. And again, just like Morrison, like just the beauty of the language and her voice is so idiosyncratic and powerful. And I think her TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, has really made the rounds. I think most of our students at West have seen it, but if you want to punch that up into YouTube and hear that, that's a beautiful talk as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I also read this in the last few years, and I would put it on my list of one of my favorite books of all time, I think, that I've ever read. And it's so interesting to hear. I mean, obviously you and I come at it from a different perspective as a, you know, I'm a white woman in her 40s, but it was mind opening in so many ways. Plus it's also delightful and heartbreaking and funny and all the good things that you want out of a book. And I think that that's an important point to make when we're talking about literature, and you mentioned it earlier, that it's not just that we have to engage with difficult subjects. There's just so much great African-American literature out there that's just great literature. You enter it as a reader, not you're going to learn something, but that's not the only point, right?
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that and reinforcing that. You know, it's this tension between how do we engage with this experience, acknowledging the part of it that is a struggle authentically, but while also inhabiting and celebrating, you know, these artworks as you said, delightful and beautiful and just overall aesthetically pleasing. I think that being able to do both of those things at the same time is super important. And I would really be saddened if people were put off from picking up books by Black authors thinking that they were only going to engage with something that was just going to zap them emotionally and be this really heavy, you know, literary burden to carry. Like, no, you can Not that there aren't books that focus more on that, but there's so much more out there and such a wider experience that you can inhabit joyfully.
Amari Nassafi, thank you so much for sharing this list with us today and for adding at least three books to my to-be-read pile, which keeps on growing, but I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure anytime we get together to talk about books and ideas.
Amari Nassafi, he teaches high school English at West High School in Iowa City. And I'll repeat that list he put together again, Stamped by Ibram Kendi and Jason Reynolds. That's a version of Ibram Kendi's book Stamped from the Beginning for younger readers. Black Enough, a short story collection by various authors, including Jason Reynolds and Nick Stone. The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. Losing My Cool by Thomas Chatterton Williams, and Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. There is a unique Iowa history attraction in West Des Moines. It's the Jordan House, an imposing structure, a Victorian home of Italianate Gothic design. It's one of the oldest buildings in Polk County and the oldest in West Des Moines, and it is celebrated in particular for one element of its history. It was a stop on the Underground Railroad, the Freedom Trail. Gail Brubaker is executive director of the West Des Moines Historical Society, and she's here to talk to us about the Jordan House. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Miss Nebbe. Nice to talk to you.
Well, lovely to have you here. And let's go way, way, way back in time to when James Jordan, who built this home, came to Iowa way back in 1844. So he was a cattle rancher from Virginia. What brought him to the Iowa Territory?
Well, the part of the country that he was from originally was a slaveholding state. We now know it as West Virginia. And the family decided they had to, for moral reasons, move west and live in a free state. So the plan was to go to Oregon, but Iowa is a heck of a lot closer. At this point, they were living in Missouri. So James and his brother John were the Iowa equivalent of Sooners. They snuck up to the territory before they were legally allowed to check out the area. And my gosh, it's absolutely perfect for shorthorn cattle ranching. So that's what brought them up here.
All right. So yes, when we say 1844, Iowa wasn't opened up to settlement until 1845.
Correct. So these Southern men were just so charming. The soldiers at the Fort Des Moines, instead of kicking them out, which they should have done, said, let us show you this absolutely amazing part of central Iowa, where there's plentiful water, open grazing, amazing walnut trees to build a beautiful home. And that's why we have the Jordan House today.
All right. Well, I want to talk about this family. I want to talk about the Jordan House, but I do want to acknowledge that, of course, when this land was settled, it's not like this land was vacant. We're going to talk about the Jordan's role in helping freedom seekers find their way to safety, but also this land was taken from Native people. And so they were a part of that process as well. We have a long, complicated history. So let's talk about when they first built a structure here in Iowa. Of course, this wasn't West Des Moines. this didn't become West Des Moines for a very, very long time. So they were obviously in a very rural area.
Oh, very rural. And that is part of the reason why it works so well to be part of the Underground Railroad. There were no neighbors around to check out what these Jordans were doing. But yes, the stories that we have been told is that the nearest kind of permanent neighbors were in Carlisle. So this was an incredibly rural protected area.
And this family must have been very successful, because we look at the structure now and it is a beautiful, beautiful, ornate old home. Tell me how the family found their way to so much wealth and success.
The Jordan family even his mom were amazing real estate flippers for the time. They would move to a state such as Michigan, where the Jordan brothers met and married the Pittman sisters, buy up farms, kind of pad their coffers, sell their cattle, and then move on to a new place. So that is how they were able to become so wealthy. But I do need to point out, the house is in amazing shape and a beautiful landmark because of the work of a lot of volunteers and support from donors, especially the city of West Des Moines. There would be no Jordan House today if it wasn't for those volunteers and the city's support.
Well, in fact, the house was almost burned down as an exercise for the fire department, right?
Exactly. Can you even imagine?
What a shame.
It was, oh, thank goodness that people got together and got fired up, no pun intended, to save this building. Because while it is an amazing building and structure, I think it is also this fantastic symbol for the fight for freedom, the fight for doing what is right for your fellow man and woman. So I really appreciate it just as an amazing place to come to work every day, but also what it stands for.
So the Jordans wanted to come to Iowa, or originally Oregon, because they wanted to live in a free state. Do we know what kind of experience James Jordan had that made him feel so strongly as an abolitionist?
We do. His immediate family, his parents, did not own enslaved people, but he did have family members who lived close by in Virginia that did. When he was a young man, James was forced to go on a slave hunt. A group of the enslaved individuals owned by his family had made a run for it, and James was forced to go and help. And they caught them, and these human beings fell to their knees and begged God to save them. Obviously, that didn't happen. And James wrote about how horrifying that experience was. And he was an abolitionist for what we would say are the right reasons. He truly believed in the freedom and humanity of other people, regardless of the color of their skin. And he was a Methodist. Methodists and Quakers at that time had very strong abolitionist beliefs as a general rule. So he was talking the talk and walking the walk, definitely.
Now, in recent years, we have learned a great deal more about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. Of course, records weren't kept of the activities of the Underground Railroad because keeping records put people at risk. And the late Doug Jones, who worked for the Office of the State Archaeologist, and Lowell Soike, they have done so much research that has really uncovered some incredible stories and elements of this Freedom Trail in Iowa. How do we know about the Jordan House and the Underground Railroad?
Well, James was pretty out in the open about what he was doing and what his beliefs were. He was one of the very first Republicans in Iowa. Here at the Jordan House, one of the things that we have that is original is a lithograph of Abraham Lincoln hanging over the fireplace. And the family has told us that was there until the day James died in 1891. So if you are not out in the open about what you believe in and what you're doing, you're not going to have a picture of the president, the deceased president, who was really hated by a large chunk of the population. John Brown, who that radical abolitionist, wrote about his visits to the Jordan House, especially with this last group of freedom seekers that he liberated and escorted to Canada. And they were actually here on February 17th, 1859. So we know that they stayed with the wagons up at the top of the hill on the Jordan property, and most likely did come to the house for food and clothing and medical treatment. So John Brown was a great storyteller, and that is one of the stories that he told that we're so proud of.
And you also have evidence of James Jordan corresponding with other abolitionists in Iowa as well, like Josiah Grinnell, for example.
This state was a hotbed of abolitionists, so it's something that I think we should all be proud of. And, you know, let's be realistic. These people like Jordan and Grinnell and Grimes, Governor Grimes, were protected to a certain extent because of their wealth and the color of their skin. there were plenty of folks who we don't know about, especially the freedom seekers who self-liberated. We will never know their stories, unfortunately. So that's why I think it's important to try to be as inclusive and open as possible and celebrate all of their lives, not just the wealthy folks who were protected from possible federal persecution.
Right, and could take these risks to help people.
Yes.
I think a lot of people, when they first learn about the Underground Railroad, of course, that fills your mind with all kinds of images and ideas, one of them being places to hide underground. So at the Jordan House, a lot of people want to think that, that freedom seekers would have found shelter in the cellar, but that's not what happened. So tell me what we know about how the people at the Jordan House would help people.
Well, from what we have learned, and as I said, we have a letter from John Brown talking about how he left the freedom seekers up at the top of the hill, which makes sense. There were a lot of people chasing John Brown and their group on this last trip across Iowa. So you would much rather be at the top of a hill or in hidden in a barn or in the middle of a cornfield if the slave catchers were coming to get you. But we do know that one of the things that the women did who were part of the Underground Railroad, they would get together and have weekly sessions of knitting and preserving food and sewing clothing. So when the freedom seekers came through, they would get care packages from the families. So let's also celebrate the role of women as part of the Underground Railroad and helping freedom seekers.
And why do you think it's important to have this really tangible reminder of the fight for equality?
I think a lot of times we need to see things to be reminded of what our history is. Unfortunately, it feels like we are forgetting history and in some cases repeating negative parts of it. So here we have a building that is absolutely stunning, but it also sends a message. One person can make a tremendous difference in a lot of lives. We will never know how many freedom seekers actually came through the Jordan House. We have photographs, actually, of Henry Bell, a freedom seeker who allegedly was helped by the Jordans and settled in Des Moines and became an amazing, respected businessman, he and his wife. What a difference one person reaching out, doing what is right, made in Henry Bell's life and his wife's life. Who else can we help by doing the right thing?
Gail, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Charity.
I've been talking with Gail Brubaker, Executive Director of the West Des Moines Historical Society, and we've been focusing on the Jordan House. It's the oldest structure in West Des Moines, and it was a stop on the Underground Railroad, the Freedom Trail. Thank you.